Esther 4. Esther 4, verses 10 through 12. Again, Esther spake unto Hadak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put into death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. We've now seen that Mordecai has managed to provoke Esther. He's provoked her to send her most trusted courtier to identify him and send him to speak with him outside the gate. And this eunuch has been given very sensitive information. Information that could be viewed by certain parties within the king's court especially as subversive. Mordecai has given Hadak not only the what, that's information regarding the planned extermination of the Jews, nuts and bolts of that plan, but also the why, and he's included names and motives. Now, should his accusations, should the nature of the controversy become known before its proper time, everyone who has knowledge of the causes and the contest, including this eunuch, is going to be in danger of being brought to judgment before what we can only assume will be a very unsympathetic Persian court. Now, we already know the punishment for treason was death. And that punishment for treason is probably how Haman is going to have to constrain himself to characterize this exchange if he's going to get what he wants, and that is keep this plot moving. So conceivably, this would reach to the highest ranks and possibly remove and destroy even the queen, Esther. Even the queen herself could be taken down by this plot. Now, should any in the kingdom hear that the king had refused Haman's offer of money to destroy the Jews, it's very likely that they might conclude that the king then perhaps was moved by some higher principle than love of monetary gain. You know, that's a natural inclination to patriotism. Perhaps they might think this was a question of nationalism, national security, national pride, or something. Perhaps it might be construed in their minds to involve the security of the empire. But very few people, at least outside of the circle of the children of Israel, very few would ever have seen this for what it really was. That is, very few would have looked through the outward trappings, the outward appearances, and perceived here that ancient contest between the seed of the woman, the church, and the seed of the serpent, that is, the unbelieving world. I suspect that few among the heathen would ever perceive the deep religious nature of this conflict, excepting perhaps a few who, like Haman, were of a certain educated status of religious heathens, who had some concept that religion has to do with everything, not just a superstitious construction, but actually a philosophical bent of mind that would lead them to that conclusion. the result of this is this. This whole empire, the Persian Empire, like every empire of the beast, and that's all that they are, right? Egypt was an empire of the beast. Babylon, the Medes, and now the Persians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans, and you know, now the American, right? It's just gone down through history. Every empire that arises on earth conducts itself by this godless head trying to make war with the remnant of the seed of the woman. Because that's all they're going to be. As long as they reject the claims of Christ at a national level, if the empire is not going to be Christian, it will be motivated by hatred to Christianity. There's no mistaking why we are where we are. But the godless head of this beast is going to make war with the remnant of the seed of the woman. However, as the prophecy says in Revelation, the earth will open her mouth and swallow the flood which the dragon casts out of his mouth. So it's going to happen here again. It happens again and again. It happened in Egypt. Happened in Babylon. It happened now here with the Medo-Persian Empire. It'll happen again with the Greeks. It happens again with the Romans. It always happens. In the end, they always have to serve the church. It's on your feet or on your knees, but you will serve. Now, we've also seen that sometimes bad news can be good news in disguise, or at least bad news can signal the beginning of good news. And this is especially true in these sorts of things because without the bad news that we have, there would be no correction of the course for the people of God. And without that correction, that repentance, the judgment would remain hard upon their backs until they were utterly destroyed. Nonetheless, as Calvin, for example, notes in his commentary in Psalm 135 on verse 13, and others have rightly noted from the Bible as well, this idea, God will not suffer his church to perish utterly, because if he did so, he would cease to be king. So the bad news, when it's finished its work, the bad news should help us to refocus our attention in the direction of the good news. Hatak, then, may be the bearer of bad news, but by doing this, he shall also become the agent of hope to a perishing nation of Jews. They wouldn't and couldn't have known what was happening without the pieces that Mordecai had presented to the queen. In fact, without the proper diagnosis, there is no cure. The only hope of cure begins with a good diagnosis, no matter how bad it is. So thanks to Hatak, Esther was now privy to the information necessary to advance the deliverance of the Jews. Thanks to Hatak, the Jewish dilemma and its source have been unmasked together. Thanks to Hatak, Esther is contemplating the sin of the people, the hatred of the enemies of God's people, and the evil providence that has been set before her, all together. And all of this is going to make her much more disposed to hear the instructions of Mordecai when he, in his prophetic capacity, prescribes a course of treatment, a cure, to deliver the Jewish people from the mouth of the Persian bear. More importantly, I think, all of this would provide matter of making daily prayers to God for Esther. She now knows This is something that can be committed to God in prayer. You see, like Mordecai is a true child of God, Esther's joys, Esther's griefs, Esther's praises, and Esther's prayers are all bound up with the welfare of the church. And this is instructive for all who would be counted amongst the citizens of Zion. We need to understand if we are the children of God, our lives are bound up inextricably with the body of Christ, His church. And so when the church is in a low condition, we are too, and we will be. Again, in Esther, we see that all of the temporal successes that the world can bring hang by a mere thread. Here she is at the height of power, prestige, social standing. Everything is just so, right? Just as she needs it to be, or would want it to be. With a turn of a hand, Esther realizes now all of this can be taken away. With the news coming from Mordecai, Esther faces a very possible reality that she will lose everything. And yet it's in this dark providence that we see how often it is God permits His church to be taken into captivity for her sins. And there in captivity brought to nearly to utter ruin. Sometimes even to the gates of death and hell. And yet, as cast down and cast off as the state of the church has been again and again, and we see this both in Scripture and in the history of the Christian church, how often it is God takes His people there and just in the nick of time, He leads them out again. How often those words of the former prophet have been confirmed in the church as God works great deliverances. 1 Samuel 12:16. He says, "Now, therefore, stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes." This amazing thing. How often in the Bible are we, in a sense, in terms of the doomsday clock, you know, 1 minute from midnight when everything is gone forever? How many times in the history of the Christian church has that happened, where things have been turned so bad, things go so badly for the people of God because of the sins of the church, that it looks as if all prospect of recovery is gone? And yet again and again, God at that last minute, last glimmer of hope, and God pulls it out. Finally, there is, I think, a suggestion here, and something the rabbis note, and I think you should keep in mind. Esther, I think, should remind us of Joseph, who, like her, he found himself in the house of Pharaoh, the head of the beastly empire of his day, the Egyptian kingdom. She, like him, is now at this point where she is brought to a remembering of her brethren, precisely when the time of Israel's need of help arises. Now, in that, Esther and Joseph show themselves to be the true children of God, they're not like so many who, when they come to positions of wealth or power, forget their poor relatives or near brethren. But they show mercy to their poor brethren, who are also the people of God. As Paul says in Galatians 6, as we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. So verse 10. Again, Esther spake unto Hadak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. Again, Esther spake unto Hadak. This clause reminds us here that Esther, although she was a queen, she clearly was not a free woman. She was, as I've noted, more like a prisoner in a gilded cage. Meant to be the wife of the king, meant to be kept confined, be shut up from others, especially from men. The only exception to male company, if you're the queen, would have been those men that attended to her, those men who were guarding her, those men who were catering to her needs and conveying her messages to and fro. But the catch is this. All of those men must needs be eunuchs. Castrati. Castrated men. Men who would pose no possible threat to keeping the bloodline of the king pure. So yes, he wants men to guard her. But he doesn't want men guarding her who could possibly interfere with this idea of purity of bloodline. Now, in a kingdom with regular succession from the father to the son, or in the case that there's not an acceptable child or no child at all, from the king to the nearest acceptable blood relation, which at this time was almost always male, all right, the purity of the bloodline was viewed as particularly important. So whenever Esther wishes to send a message, her courier is going to be one of the eunuchs. Here then, when Esther wishes to communicate outside of her house, she has to use the channels appointed to her. The king has given her these eunuchs, and he's given her, in particular, this one Hadak that she views as being particularly suited. Remember, she's already, from Mordecai's initial response, she's already begun to think that there probably is some sensitive information to be conveyed here. Because of the sensitivity of information that's going to be conveyed back and forth, and it's already been conveyed back and forth, one more time now, she calls for Hadak, a eunuch, as they say, both suited to the task, because he's allowed to go outside the king's gates, but one who also has a record, a proven record, a track record of trustworthiness. He's brought a word from Mordecai. And now she summons him again to give him instructions. This time, however, she's not seeking to get information. Rather, this time she calls him. She's eager to send information to Mordecai, which she now believes, having thought about what he said, she thinks this is probably pertinent to the command he's laid upon her. So she spake unto Hadak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. Again, the instruction that Esther had for Hadak was in the form of a commandment to be delivered to Mordecai. Now, according to one of the Targums, which are the ancient Jewish interpretive texts, they're rabbinic commentaries. According to one of the Targums, Esther ordered Hadak to go and say to Mordecai something like this. that he shouldn't stir up strife with Haman by taking upon himself the enmity that existed between Jacob and Esau. Esther also, we're told in this Targum, put words into Hadad's mouth, saying to him, "Speak thus to Mordecai. Has not the wicked Haman decreed throughout, through the command of Xerxes, that is Ahasuerus, that no one may go in unto the king into the inner court without permission?" The first part of this instruction that we're told in the Targum was given to Hadad at this time, I think, relies upon the Jewish assumption that Haman was a descendant of a family or group that has maintained hostilities against the people of God since antiquity. Now, early on, I talked a little bit, I think, about how Haman was viewed by the rabbis as somehow related to the lineage of Esau. And this interpretation here relies on identifying Haman with that lineage of Esau, the seed of the serpent. Now, without pressing the point too far, that is, without actually asserting that Haman is of the line of Esau, because I doubt that. I think it's safe to say, however, the general idea is this, that there is an ancient contest, and the Jews are aware of this, the rabbis are aware, and they understand that Esther is, in her response, indicating to Mordecai she wishes him to remain aloof from it. She can see no good thing coming out of it. Why meddle in those ancient controversies? You're just asking for trouble. Don't stick your finger in that. All right, the second part of this instruction is inferred, actually, I think, from what follows in the next verse, where Esther conveys her concerns about petitioning the king. So as we're going to see, there's a prohibition, and Esther attributes this, according to Jewish lore, which is reflected in this Targum, she attributes it to Haman drawing up this edict to keep the king from obtaining more information about the plot that he set in motion against the nation of Israel. Now, that is one of those Jewish fables that I think from the rest of the text clearly cannot be true. Haman is not the one, in fact, we know he's not the one that put this into effect, but we'll discuss that in its place. Now, I think what is doubtless true at this point is this. Just as Mordecai has his own sources, his own information, Esther has her own unique information, her own unique concerns. Just as she has her own unique position or office to address the sinister plot that Haman is hatching. Now, it's notable that as these communiques are being sent back and forth, she adds to her words the authority of the queen, while Mordecai is adding to his words the authority of her uncle and I think also that of a prophet of God. So in her response now, Esther has to take into account this fact. Mordecai, who had previously told her that she was not at liberty to reveal her lineage and people, has freed her from that obligation he laid upon her when she entered the king's court. He's lifted that. So it's good, I think, to remember this. It's good to remember that everything we speak should be the truth. But that doesn't mean we're always obliged to reveal everything we know. Mordecai, as a prophet, embodies the principle of godly discretion. right? The kind that neither misleads nor foolishly blurts out that which is true before its time, right? It's characteristic of children that they say what's true at inappropriate times. Solomon says in Proverbs 12:23, a prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaimeth foolishness. It's foolishness to blurt out the truth as if you had no filter. Right? There are times and there are places. Mordecai has shown that kind of prophetic discretion. And now he's removed that barrier, that obligation. And in this, he shows God to be his father, because God did the same in revealing his plan in Christ. God doesn't reveal his plan. He didn't reveal his plan all at once, did he? We're told in Galatians 4:4, when the fullness of time has come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman, made under the law. Moreover, this timing displayed his wisdom, that his wisdom, God's wisdom, was higher than that of the enemies of God, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 8, when he says, which none of the princes of this world knew. For had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. God doesn't reveal everything all at once. He doesn't blurt everything out. He's not foolish. He knows what's in a man. Verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, there's one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I've not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. First, she begins by saying, all the king's servants. Now, that phrase that phrase denotes everyone who waits upon the king in their various capacities. So, who does it include? It includes everyone in the employ of the king, from the lowest household servant, up to the most elevated governmental officials, such as Haman. Esther now begins to paint the larger picture for Mordecai when she says this. Right? Perhaps she thinks maybe Mordecai has forgotten some of the ground rules of the kingdom. Or perhaps since Mordecai had been standing outside the gate fasting and praying in the garments of a mourner, I suppose, as the rabbis indicate, it's possible some new rule had been imposed. Whatever the source of her concern, she begins by mentioning those associated with the royal house, those with positions in the government of the kingdom. So what she's doing is she's extending her concerns to those who are at the highest echelons of Persian society. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces. Her concern continues now. She mentions all the people throughout the provinces of the king, referring to them as the people, connotes their status as a ruled or even a subjugated mass in this place, right? There's the rulers and the ruled. Okay, there are those who are working for the king and those who are working for the king, but the ones who are working for the king in this first class, they're being rewarded, right? They're the upper echelon. They're the upper class. They're the royalty. They're the glitterati of the society. Everyone else is down there. And then everyone else consists of everyone who dwells in the provinces of the king. The provinces, remember, that word is referring to those governmental districts over which that upper class in the first clause exercise their civil rule. So they're governing districts. So all these people are in contrast to those who occupy the highest levels of Persian society. So this group is meant to embrace the remainder of the people of the kingdom, all the lower strata. And so she's now basically said, in essence, however you want to divide this, upper versus lower, rulers versus ruled, royalty versus the plebs, everyone. It doesn't really matter who you are or where you are in Persian society. She says all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know. Now in Hebrew, that verb is a verb which indicates the classes of people that are mentioned are representatives possessing, already possessing some kind of knowledge. Now today, we might call this kind of knowledge common knowledge. It's common knowledge, this or that. Common knowledge because it's not merely known, but it's well known, and it's well known throughout the length and the breadth of the empire. From the highest to the lowest social class, everyone knows. That's the gist of the Hebrew term used here. She's saying it's common knowledge. And so I think there's a hint, perhaps, here of a notion in her mind. She's kind of saying, since this is so well known, how can this be that you, Mordecai, being a learned man, a prophet of God, one who sat for a time in the palace of the king, how could you be so ignorant of what I'm about to tell you? That's kind of what she's getting at here. This is common knowledge, but you don't seem to get this. You don't seem to understand this. Why? What's going on? Some sort of disconnect. And I think it's precisely at this point that the people, those people who thought that this is referring to some new law enacted by the hand of Haman using the king's signet, this is where they try to make their case, right? This is common knowledge, but somehow you don't get it. You don't know it. You somehow were out of that loop. Everyone else in the country, in the empire, got the memo, but you. Imagine some great national disaster that's well publicized. In this country, or in any other country that pertains to that nation. In a very short period of time, it's hard to imagine anyone in that country hasn't heard of it. And you would be surprised. Just, it's very unusual. And I think that's the idea. It's very unusual. There's something strange. It seems as though Mordecai should have been familiar with this rule or law. Okay? That's her thinking. And I would suggest that actually Mordecai almost certainly is familiar with this law. He just doesn't care. Okay? That's not his concern right now. He's a very different concern. But she's thinking about things from where she's sitting. As I'm going to point out in a few minutes, it's not only unlikely, it's nearly impossible to come to the conclusion that this law first arose under Haman, because we actually know when this law arose. So all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman. Now, what is Esther doing here? She's not only saying that the rule that she is about to place before Mordecai, not only does it pertain to everyone, regardless of status, high or low in the society, wherever you are in the empire, every part, every province of the king, she also wants to make it very, very clear here, this law, this rule or law, does not make allowances for the different sexes, man or woman. right? Doesn't matter if you're male or female. One law for all. And I think it's precisely in this one-size-fits-all approach that the Persian government has with this law that the absurdity of the law begins to peek through, because it's a rule that knows of no exceptions, and that, in the realm of human laws, always proves to be destructive, because man does not possess the competent measure of knowledge needed to pass those kinds of comprehensive laws. Okay, it's just not wise for men to try to pass laws that are applicable under every circumstance, no matter what. And yet, Esther is saying, that's exactly what this law is. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court. Now here's exactly what Mordecai has demanded she would do. Why would he say do that when she's saying it's common knowledge you don't do that? Even me, I can't do that. Common knowledge. He commanded Esther to go before the king and petition him. And yet Esther is now responding, and this is a very human point of view, responding by pointing out the great difficulty and, as we're going to see, danger at this time in approaching the king. The Persian king had an inner court or courtyard, which was his exclusive habitation. And only those with express permission were allowed to enter that area, and that restriction applied to everyone, as I say, including the queen. Whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called. Again, it's not that you could never come, but you had to be called, you had to be summoned to come to the king. Now, the law that is in view, we're told, was designed to protect the king's dignity from unwarranted intrusions and his person from assassination. They're trying to block him off. Herodotus, actually, the ancient historian, tells us this law was first enacted by Deoces. He was the first shaw, the first priest of the kingdom of the Medes. He reigned approximately between 727 and 675 B.C. Now, we know that toward the end of the Median reign, at one point, this law had become so restrictive that only six companions were able to approach Darius when he was upon his throne. That's what we're told in the ancient histories. Herodotus goes on to say that this law was enforced by the Persian monarchs when they ascended to power in the empire. Now remember, Esther takes place during the reign of Ahasuerus, who we believe was Xerxes I, who reigned from 486 to 465 B.C. That, you know, it's not too long after. But because we know this, the notion that Haman would have been the architect of this rule is not only highly unlikely, I would say it's just simply not the case. Now, the Jewish tradition that he was the one who enacted it might actually have to do with something else. And that might be this. It may well be that for a time there had been some relaxation that under Haman this law is given new enforcement. And he was probably going to use this law anyway to protect his interest in persecuting the Jews when that becomes his hobby horse. Okay? But remember, after that case, the treachery of Bigthan and Teresh. After all of that had been unveiled, think of it as a nation having laws for national security on the books, but they're not really enforcing them. But after you have this close call, all of a sudden the enforcement of laws that were already on the books becomes very, what we would call draconian, right? It's very, very strict, very circumspect. That's perhaps what it is they're hinting at has happened here, right? That with, and as I say, it's quite natural, I think, that Haman is going to avail himself of whatever tools that are put at his disposal to prevent any from thwarting his plot. So a guy like Haman is not going to feel in any way limited or restrained. He's going to use that kind of law to his advantage in pushing his agenda. So all the king's servants, the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king in the inner court who is not called, there's one law of his to put him to death. Literally, the Hebrew says here, one is his law, which is the way of saying there's one law which extends to everyone. And that's what Esther's already explained, right? No one was allowed to enter so much as his inner court without that summons, that royal summons. The penalty for coming without that summons was death. And, you know, depending, it may have been quite sudden, as we're going to see later on in the Book of Esther. You know, in other words, you may enter, and if you don't have that summons, the assumption might be a very bad thing for you, and they might rush upon you and just kill you right there. But the fact is, it's death. That's the penalty. Now, this aspect of the law is also mentioned by Herodotus, who also states, by the way, that it was possible to send a messenger or a message to the king, I should say, requesting an audience before him. Okay, so you didn't just have to passively wait for a summons. You could, if you wanted to come, you could send a message and request a summons. Without that provision, as one commentator noted, the king effectively would have been cut off from communication with his kingdom. Now, why Esther doesn't suggest that option, we're going to consider in a moment. But that was a possibility. Now, I want you to notice that while Esther's not flatly declining to obey Mordecai, she is very eager to remind him of the great danger she's going to enter if she goes before the king without prior approval. She's trying to make it very clear to him, even her royal title, even the fact that she's queen, cannot save her if she goes without the king's permission. It's a death penalty. So any of the that come into the king, under the king, into the inner court, who is not called, there's one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter. So there is one exception to this death penalty. And it is an exception that probably is less certain and less rewarding than playing the lottery. If the king decides at that moment to let you go, he can hold out the golden scepter. The death penalty is avoidable if the person in question happens to elicit a particular response from the king. Now, why does it say he has to hold out the golden scepter? Well, first, I think we should note the scepter is said to be golden, which, by the way, Homer in his book, The Odyssey, confirms that that's exactly the kind of thing that the Persian king would have had, a golden scepter. Gold was the metal of royalty, and everything pertaining to the royal estate was covered, embossed, or cast in gold. Everything. The throne, the crown, all of the things surrounding. The scepter in particular, it's important that this is gold. That was the royal staff of authority. You know, the king would, in a sense, signal to the court. You know, he was sort of used like magicians of old would use their staffs. They would wave it, and they wave it to summon and do this or do that. That's the way they used that. It represented the pointing and the attention of the royal authority in this or that direction. So inclining the scepter toward a person was a sign that the visiting person was welcome to come before the throne. In fact, quite often in ancient assemblies, the herald, the person who would announce the visitors coming in, would give the scepter to the person in that assembly, showing that he, or I guess in our case, she, had authority to speak in that assembly. So we know that a similar thing happens in the U.S. Congress where they hand the gavel to the speaker. Right? You have the floor, they gavel, but they hand the gavel to the person who has the authority, and he gavels. You know, it's a big hammer. That's a cheaper version of what Ahasuerus is using here. He's a golden scepter. So accept such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. And should the king stretch forth his arm and hold out the scepter to the person entering without the royal summons, it signifies in that motion a full and free pardon from the death penalty that was prescribed by law. Again, Herodotus in his histories confirms this aspect of the law among the Medes and the Persians. So here, Esther presents a possible avenue of exception, but we need to remember she's not really very certain that this course is going to be granted to her, even though she is a queen. And the reason why she now adds to her assessment of the feasibility of carrying out Mordecai's commandment to her, she's giving her assessment from her point of view. And so she concludes by saying, "But I have not been called to come into under the king these 30 days." So she's telling Mordecai she has no way that she can see to obtain an audience with the king. It's been 30 days, a full month, since he's even desired her company. So the prospect of a royal summons at this point seems to be remote. While we're not told of the reason why Ahasuerus has lost interest in Esther, many surmise that there's another woman from the harem. And I think even Matthew Henry suggests that it wouldn't be out of character for Haman to have placed some other woman there. Although I don't really see a reason why Haman would be that interested because, as we're going to see, he still does not know she is of Jewish descent. So he doesn't really know that she's related. Of course, if there is another woman, if that's the case, then it might also make Esther feel a bit pessimistic about her chances of receiving a royal summons. After all, now in our history at Esther, we have to remember it's been about 5 years since their marriage. And Esther's at this point, knowing her husband, the king, had lost some interest. And she probably thought it was very ill-advised to presume to come into his inner court without some indication that his affection for her had not abated. She might have been concerned he was looking for some way out of his marriage and she didn't want to give him a good legal out. So in verse 12, and they told to Mordecai Esther's words. And they told. Now, from this point on in the book of Esther, Hatak is mentioned no more. And in this verse, we have a switch from the singular him to they. And that switch has occasioned no little conjecture. There are a lot of people who just simply think, despite textual evidence to the contrary, that this is just a problem in the text. There's been some corruption that's crept in. There's no indication of that at all. The rabbis thought that Haman had discovered the courier, Hatak. I remember, I think I told you, they believed that Hatak was actually Daniel. And that they had him killed for his role in carrying news back and forth between Esther and Mordecai. So the rabbis go on to say that after his death, the angels, Michael and Gabriel, then take the news from Esther to Mordecai. And hence, the change in pronoun from him to they. I think that, again, is an example of Jewish fables. I think it's far better to follow the explanation of one commentator who points out that this change of voice, which is really what's going on, to they, as an indefinite subject used here, is because the narrator of the book of Esther has switched from indirect discourse, which we see going on up through verse 9, to direct discourse. So that the change of number, that is, from the singular to the plural, from him to they, that actually represents a literary development in the text that sees the narrator assume the foreground in the last verses of this chapter. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let me explain a little bit more as we go. When it says, and they told is a narrative device meant to assure us that all the information that was necessary was conveyed in this exchange. Nothing pertinent was left out. Nothing superfluous was added. They told to Mordecai. Mordecai is the recipient of Haddock's acting the part of a messenger. But remember that the action, which has heretofore been indirect, is now moving from a kind of passive situation where we're sort of listening in to one that is designed to draw the reader here into its action actively. Right? So we're being moved from this indirect to this direct action by this change in language. It's a literary device, as I said. It's a literary development. Hatak is not only the queen's courier here, but in a sense, from the point of view of the narrator of Esther, he is now the literary courier bringing the message of the book of Esther to an ever-present audience. It's like moving into the ever-present tense. And if we understand the continued use to this day of the book of Esther in conjunction with the celebration of the Feast of Purim, which is established toward the end of this book, the fact that they are so involved every time Haman's name is mentioned, they gnash their teeth and all of that, that I think is borne out by this literary change. So they told to Mordecai the words of Esther, the words, things, and matters of Esther, from the subject matter brought to Mordecai's attention. That's the subject matter that is brought not only by Hatak, but it's being brought to our attention as well. And so, as Mordecai now speaks, the literary change suggests, or I think is meant to suggest, that his words now are spoken not only to the past, but that they have a peculiar applicability to the people of God down through the ages. Now, I think this change in language here is like that change that John describes, the Apostle John, in the Revelation, when the Spirit of God lifts him up and places him in the wilderness so he can begin to see clearly the identity of the enemy of the people, or the enemy of the church. Right? This is what's happening here. There's a sort of lifting up. And whereas we were listening to something that was indirect, now we're being engaged directly by the storyline. And that's what happens with John. In Revelation 17:3, John says, "So he, that is the Spirit, carried me away," or God, "carried me away in the Spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now, why is perspective such an important thing in the Bible? Why is it necessary for John to go into the wilderness to understand the identity of this beast? Well, John knew the wilderness was the place where the woman, the witnessing church, the remnant of those who kept the testimony of Jesus, that's where she was during the time of apostasy and persecution. Revelation 12:14. "And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent." Now here, in the book of Esther, Mordecai and Esther represent the witnessing church, that same witnessing church that John will talk about later in Revelation, as she suffers under the apostasy of the majority of the Jews scattered throughout the empire, as well as the persecution which is arising from the direction of Haman, who is the seed of the serpent. And for us to understand, to gain that understanding, we need to be brought into the perspective of those people of God. And that, I think, is what's going on. By moving from an indirect kind of action now into a direct kind of action, we're being asked to occupy the position of that ancient people of God and identify with them so that we might understand what they're going through, that we might be instructed in and by them. Now, that might seem a little strange, but it turns out that with regard to Haman in Hebrew, the name Haman, the wicked, that is Haman Rasha, Haman the wicked has the numerical value of 666. And in this, he has been, from time to time, it's been noted by people that he is a type of the coming Antichrist, who is a priest, again, representing a false religion, has enlisted the aid of an ungodly magistrate, time and time again. Antichrist persecutes in this way, trying to suppress the true religion. So I think that is what's going on here. I want you to consider how foolish the law of the Medes and the Persians was on this point, that all who came before them uncalled should be put to death. It's quite likely, as Matthew Henry has noted, that such a law would have made the kings very unhappy, because they would have been confined to the innermost portions of the inner court. The throne for the king would have been little more than a seat in a royal prison from which the kings might rule, but they would do so without very much knowledge of their kingdom, very little connectivity. They would be themselves like prisoners for the most part. And so correctly it's been said, I think, that this might lead them to become morose and even melancholy, and that in turn would tend to make them both a terror to others and a burden to themselves. Being locked up in a gilded prison But all you can contemplate all day long is the destruction of yourself or someone else. It's not a good place to be. Again, this would have been quite bad for the subjects of such rulers as well, right? They would be excluded on most occasions from having access to the redress from the highest court in the kingdom, that of the kings. You couldn't do it without a royal summons. And so that recourse would have been cut off from all but the most, either the most desperate, have nothing else to lose, I'll take a shot, if I die, I die, or those who are just most cavalier, they just don't care. Anyone else is going to be kept from seeking that level of justice in that kind of system. And then as far as the queen was concerned, it must have been particularly vexing to her. You think about that. The law made no exception even for her. She's his wife. She's supposed to be, as Matthew Henry points out, his flesh and his bones. But as I've said before, though she was to be the most near and dear, she was really, and given this law, not too far from his own estate, she was merely first among unequals in a kingdom ruled by an arbitrary despot, who himself was by this time become a prisoner of his own position. Now, if we consider all of this together, Esther's situation made it appear that Mordecai's command is not only not promising, but frankly, probably quite discouraging. There's nothing to which she could point at the moment that favored the course prescribed by Mordecai. She has looked around. She's thought about this. She surveyed the scenario, and it seemed to her that Providence had ordered events in such a fashion that every door was closed. And humanly speaking, things couldn't be much worse. And yet it is precisely here that God, through his prophet Mordecai, calls Esther to have faith, as we're going to see in the concluding verses of this chapter. Faith, after all, must have an eye not to frowning providence, but to the smiling assurances of the promises of God, which are writ large in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Esther is going to be called not to be faithless, but believing. And though it might be true that the king's heart was diverted from her, and I agree it's quite likely that wicked Haman was doing everything he could to, at least to keep the king's attention unfocused as the date approached for the destruction of the Jews. Right? The less the king was thinking about anything, the less likely he's going to think about doing anything to stop his plan against the Jews. And yet in all of this, it remained and remains true, as Solomon says in Proverbs 21, that the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it whithersoever he will. Now, should Esther have respect to the command of Mordecai merely as a man? I have no doubt that she would fail and come short of the promise. Should she have respect to his words as her superior, even as one who was to her like a surrogate father? Well, at least then, I think she would reap the reward of filial obedience. However, she should have had respect, and I think she does and will, to the command of Mordecai as her father in the faith, even as a prophet of God, as one who is speaking the promise of light in the darkness of the moment. And when she moves because of that, then she will see the deliverance of her people and the glory of God shining in the kingdom of the Persians as it's never been seen before there. Notice Esther here exhibits some fear of death. That's natural because there's planted in every man a love of life. That same fear, by the way, is also probably, I think, one of the things that caused Moses to hesitate when God called him to deliver Israel. In fact, there are very few who, like the Apostle Paul, who could say that they don't count their lives dear to themselves so long as they might finish the course with joy. We need to remember, however, that Paul did have an advantage over Esther and Moses. And that's an advantage that we also now have. We know that Jesus has abolished death and brought life and immortality to light by the gospel. Esther is living at a time and has yet to believe without seeing God manifest in the flesh. And nonetheless, before she can yield any obedience, we see in her hesitation here for a moment that she is going to have to crucify her corrupt reasoning and die to herself. And that is what each one of us must do if we would glorify God and see his glory revealed in the earth. So in conclusion, consider what a blessing we have. Because the kingdom of God is unlike the courts of earthly kings. We're not left like those in the Persian Empire, wondering if we can come before the king. The royal summons of the gospel has gone forth, and for all who believe, we are told that we can come boldly before the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and help in time of need. It's true, the heathen who are locked up in Satan's kingdom, the heathen still tremble at the thought of approaching the throne of God the King. That's why they're afraid of death. It's still for them a certain death sentence coming before him, a certain sentence of condemnation. But Christ, the Son of God, has held forth the golden scepter and proffered peace and pardon if we would only exercise faith. So I say, let us then beseech the living God to grant to each one of us faith that we might believe and grace that we might come boldly, knowing that our petitions will be heard, not for anything that we've done, but for Christ's sake, who loved us and gave himself for us. Amen.